Kia ora and welcome to Machinist Therapy Hotline, the podcast made by machinists for machinists. And your hosts today are Tony Closer.
Welcome, amigos.
Shane Paul.
G'day.
Albert Rogzinski.
Oh, hey.
And me, Jody Tuckwell, where we'll be discussing topics that have been requested by you, and hopefully we'll be able to shed some light on them. So, without further ado, let's get on with the podcast. What do you reckon? Welcome to episode 3, everyone. So, let's kick things off. Albert, why don't you tell us what your topic is for this episode?
I believe I picked two topics, actually. Somebody, and I'm trying to find their name right now, asked about basically how you handle costly mistakes or costly screw-ups in the shop. And then somebody else, who I'm also trying to find, they were asking about time management and, you know, how you kind of manage your time as like either a shop owner or maybe a manager or something.
Cool.
So I guess I don't want to short one question to the other because they're both pretty important and they're both things that I think are a big part of our days. But I do probably have a little bit more to say about time management as a owner, just because to me, like, time management is, it's like key. That's everything. I'm not really sure where to start, but as far as, you know, managing your time, like you, I mean, that's the most important thing that you can do. You need to, prioritizing is key. And, you know, because you're directing other people around the shop, like you, I mean, you need to, I guess, be as efficient as you can with your time management. You know, how does that phrase go? It's like, are you at work or are you actually working at work? I don't know if I messed that up, but there's a lot of people that are at work, but not really working. And there's people that are at work and they're working all the time. So, you know, to me, like, I mean, I think it comes naturally, like as a machinist, you know, everything that we do kind of revolves around being efficient, optimizing processes and stuff like that. And so I try to carry that over like into my like day-to-day operations, I guess. And just, you know, manage my time as efficiently as possible. Maybe one of you guys has something to chime in about this and kind of jog me along here. I'm kind of grasping.
No, I'd like to maybe just jump in a little bit. So for me personally, I use, and this is going to sound totally like Gordon Gekko style 80s stock man, but I use a Franklin Covey style diary system, so almost like a bloody Filofax. And I, at the beginning of my day, I write out a list of all the things that I want to achieve, and I categorize them in A's, B's, C. A being I have to do it, B I can get onto it if I've done an A, and C is like an add-in that would be nice to have. I then have my I have the timeline from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. and I put in any, you know, meetings or whatever that I might have. And then the following day, you know, and if I've not done all the things on the A list, that has to be transferred through to the next day, because, you know, it's fine writing a list, but a lot of people write a list of unachievable things. You'll go, oh my God, I need to get this done, this done, this done, this done. But it's just not realistic. And what you end up doing is just a lot of things really poorly. And it's better to get things done correctly than to, well, just do things really shit.
That kind of sounds like a Monday, to be honest.
Well, I have a question for you on that, Jody. Do you actually, on your A, B, C list, do you actually pencil in time for comedy, as in when you put post-it notes on your face and take a picture and send them to us?
I think we need to post that on the account, actually.
So that is on the D list.
That is A plus.
Priority.
I love it, brother.
But actually, in all seriousness, I found that honestly is the best way for me to achieve what I hope to achieve. And, you know, a lot of people go, oh, my God, yeah, but with all modern-day technology now, you know, you can have these things in your phones with reminders, and you can have a special calendar that pops up on your desktop. And I just actually find that if I write things down, I remember to do them. And if it's, you know, and the worst thing is when you say, right, I want to achieve this, and it's like 4 o'clock and you've basically only ticked one thing off your list, and you're like, where did it go wrong? What the fuck stopped me from doing that?
It's interesting that you, it's actually, I'm glad that you brought up the list thing, because I don't know why I blanked on that, but I make lists like on the daily for everything. And especially like work related stuff. I kind of follow a very similar system to what you do. And, you know, I mentioned that about Mondays or whatever. And like Mondays, I tend to always be a little bit over ambitious and try to bite off more than I can chew. And then by the end of the day, it's like, it's not that I haven't been managing my time effectively, but I just haven't gotten as much done as I wanted to accomplish. And it kind of, it's like a little bit of a reality check, just like how much stuff you have to do and how you need to stay on top of prioritizing it, I guess.
Mine's a lot more chaotic. What I typically do is, like, at the beginning of the day, my desk is usually pretty clean. And then as people, like, come in, you know, hey, I need this tool or I need that tool, I'll kind of just write it on a Post-it, and I'll grab, like, the catalog and throw the Post-it on it, and then just throw it on my desk. And then unless it's something, like, we absolutely have to have, like, on the afternoon truck, and I know our local supplier has it, then I'll go ahead and put it into the system. But I'll typically do that, or then I'll have, you know, like a pile of prints that I have to quote. And then, so typically by like midday, my desk is kind of like a mess. And then after, you know, all the machines get settled in, everyone's running real good. And, all my meetings are done. Cause I have at least 2 meetings every day. We do like some tiered meetings throughout the company. And I have to be a part of 2 of them every day. And then Monday I have a 3rd meeting. So usually about midday, that's when I can start knocking out all the different things on my desk. And that's kind of how I do it.
So can I just ask a question? When you say a tiered meeting, like, does everyone sit around a table and cut up onions and then they have to try and have a productive meeting with water streaming down their face?
Were you there? That's exactly how it was.
Hey, Jody, wouldn't it be cool if you could find a way just to stop time?
Oh, yeah. I would love that. You know what I would do. I would pause time and I would walk around the supermarket and take everyone's clothes off and then unpause time again.
Exactly. And say, man, this guy's holding heavy. Whoa.
He doesn't need to be in the sausage aisle because he's packing already.
He's hung like a horse.
Jesus Christ. That escalated pretty quick. What do you do, Tony, as a business owner, you know, as well? Like, how do you manage your day? Because, I mean, you're in the same boat as Albert, eh?
Well, you're right. And time, I've mentioned this before in another podcast, but working for yourself, 5 o'clock comes way too fast, and you don't have enough time to grab everything and get it in a box and get labels printed and get over to UPS. So basically what I do is I come in the morning and get everything turned on, warmed up, and then Katie comes in and she bosses me around for about 2 or 3 hours, and then she leaves, and then I follow the directions of what she said to do.
You know, another thing I was thinking about on this time management topic, you know, it sounds like a lot of us stay pretty organized, which is ideal, I would say. But I think Shane and Jody, you guys are kind of both in like more operations, it sounds like. Or like a shop foreman position. And I can relate to that because I'm also doing that as well. And I think probably a lot of what you guys end up doing is firefighting. And it kind of takes you away from your task list. And that's always been like kind of like a big stumbling block for me. So like if I'm not getting stuff done on my list, it's generally because I'm firefighting and putting out issues that come up and arise that you have to just kind of confront or handle to, you know, keep production moving, basically.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I guess as far as time management goes, that, I mean, I feel like that kind of covers it. Okay. Maybe we want to move into kind of the topic of costly mistakes or costly fuck ups, or
let's get into that.
I call it I think that we've all been there to varying degrees, and you know, it kind of always rears its head in an ugly form. We were talking about this earlier, actually. I mean, it could be either something that you guys have done in house, or maybe from an outside supplier, vendor, or whatever. It might have fucked something up for you. But yeah, I mean, there's kind of no way to avoid it. It's part of running a business. I mean, it's going to happen, and you can't ever plan for it. But I think how you react to it is kind of what determines your success as a business. You know, I think the biggest thing first and foremost is to find the root cause. That's always, you want to find out why. Like, I mean, yelling and screaming and everything, you know, that might be great, and it might make you feel good for 5 seconds. But if you don't get to the root of the problem, you know, you're just going to repeat history. So that's when you can kind of, you know, take measures to make sure, or hopefully make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we all agree that one of the, you know, outside ops that your parts may require before they come back and go out for final inspection. One of the things that's popped up in many people that I've talked to is platers. And platers are, you know, they can screw things up at the drop of a hat really fast. And if it's they're racking them in the wrong spot, or if you got something with an extreme beautiful finish that all it needs is passivation, and they're dumping them in a basket like tokens and dipping them and then pulling them back up and shipping them back to you, and it looks like somebody kicked them around the parking lot for a half hour. The only thing that I've tried to do, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but it's on the PO, be as specific as you can. Rack here, you guys have done them for 4 years, keep racking them the same, or caution, extremely good finish. I mean, put as most of the information on there that you can. But yep. The people that are packing and racking are entry level into platers, and they're the ones that handle your parts the most. And if you find a plater that you like and you have a good relationship with, and they can do your parts over and over, that's money in the bank.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they always, the platers or, you know, heat treaters or whoever, they always represent such a small portion generally of like the total cost of whatever you're working on. And they generally don't take like a lot of financial responsibility, if any, for any mess ups or screw ups. But I definitely agree that the communication thing is huge. I mean, it's huge with anything, but like, especially when working with an outside vendor, just communicating clearly. With the platers and stuff that I've worked with, there seems to be a huge communication gap. It's like they expect you to know exactly what needs to be communicated with them without actually saying anything to you. You know, everything happens so fast. It's like if you don't even request a print, like they're just going to run it and just do whatever to get it done and processed and out. You definitely have to specify as much as possible when working with some, you know, basically anybody but yourself.
Yeah, we had some parts that we would, it was a high value, it was like an Inconel shaft, and we'd machine them all out, and then there were a couple surfaces that we would get ground, and we sent them out to this grinder, and we always had really good luck with them. And then it was like all of a sudden the parts come back and they're just like thrown into a box. And the head on them had all these grooves in it, and all the grooves are smashed over. And I mean, it was just, you know, tens of thousands of dollars worth of parts. And so to ensure that didn't happen again, we went and had custom packaging made for these. And we picked a box size, and we had these foam inserts water jetted out. Yeah. And so it like nests the parts in there. And so we had to remake them. So we remake them. We send them over in our beautiful packaging. And then they come back thrown in a box the exact same way as the last time. And so
that's amazing.
That is messed up. Kill somebody.
so the owner drove over there and to see what was going on and saw all our packaging like just thrown on a shelf somewhere. And wow. They're like, oh yeah, it's all over here. So, I mean, that's something that we actually brought Passivation in-house because of this, because they were scrapping out such a large percentage of our stuff. Or we were having to rework it and polish it and then put Passagel, you know, where we polished it. So it was like, it's been a big thing for us. We're setting up on parts right now that we're making for the third time, because two different anno houses have screwed them up and tried to strip them and replate them. And then, you know, now they're out of tolerance. So
yeah, it never comes out the same when you do that.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, it's, we have, I don't know how many anno shops we have credit at now because they've, you know, screwed up all these parts, but
that's their famous go-to line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you give us another chance, we'll do them for free.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's, yeah.
But from, like, if you're making something, like, for the third time, I mean, you're making it totally at a loss, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's totally demoralizing, you know? Like, now, the parts are hard enough to make. Mm-hmm. And then someone else screws it up, and then now it's like, okay, you know, now I got to pull this out of my ass again, you know? Which, I mean, at this point, the process is pretty freaking dialed, but, you know, it should have never got to this point.
Yeah, still, it goes from something that you were making money at or could have been making money at to, like, a total loss leader.
Oh, yeah, now we're, you know, totally late on them, and the customer's upset. Which rightfully so.
Yeah. Know. And they don't care like whose fault it is necessarily. I mean, they can understand, but I guess, you know, in the effort of moving on here with this question, it's not always outside vendors that this happens at, you know, this could happen internally too. You could have like an employee that, you know, messes something up. And so it's like, how do you deal with that? You know, I feel like we touched on this a little bit, maybe like in the first episode. I think we were talking about like just management style or something like that. But you know, like how do you, I don't know, like I've had guys internally screw up parts before, and it's like, you know, that they already feel generally pretty bad about screwing it up. So it's like, you don't want to get too down their throat about it. You just want to make sure that they learn from their mistakes. And you know, how do we avoid this next time, you know, because it's like, I've made plenty of my own mistakes. I mean, that's kind of just how you learn. Again, that's like, that's something that you've got to accept. Like as a business owner, you're going to have mistakes, and that's just part of the whole process. So.
I think anytime there's like a major screw up too, it's a really good time to kind of look at, you know, the process and, you know, look for ways to, you know, ensure that it doesn't happen again. You know, if it's, hey, this is a really tight hole tolerance and the way we're checking, it's kind of booty. Like, what if we get, you know, a Sunin parking meter, you know, and check it that way. And, and I always shy away from like, measurement tools that I call them like technique based, you like know, kind of like a bore micrometer, like, you know, there's a lot of technique to using one.
Mm-hmm.
or like an inside micrometer. There's a lot of technique to using one. And if someone isn't paying attention, or they just don't know, or they, you know, they drank too much coffee and they got the shakes, like, you know, they could measure the same part three times to get three different readings. And so looking at, you know, well, what can we invest in to make this not just easier for them, but just to ensure easier for everyone and to ensure that it doesn't happen again.
What costly fuck ups have you done?
Me personally, there's been a slew of them. I remember really early on when I first started, I had a customer, and at the time they were like probably my first like large customer, and they did machining in house, but they would also outsource stuff too. And so they sent me some parts that they had worked on. They were these large, it was like 41, 4140 or 4130 parts. They had turned these blanks and they sent them to me to drill like some holes in them, right? It was, might have been like 80 parts. And it was, I think like my bill to them was like $800 or something. It was super cheap. And they didn't have a CAD file. So I just did it off of a print, and I had misinterpreted a dimension on there, and I basically fucked the parts up. So I shipped the parts back to them, and they received the parts in, and they had like QC when they would receive parts in from outside vendors. So they QC'd them and everything passed, and they checked them. And it wasn't until they shipped them to one of their customers that they realized that it was fucked up. It was basically a bolt circle that was off. And, it became this huge issue because it represented for them, I think it was like $8,000 or $9,000 worth of inventory that I had basically scrapped. It was like not reworkable. And thinking like, why? I mean, to be honest, there was enough blame to go around. I'm not going to point fingers. It was 100% my fault. But I ended up kind of working out like a deal with them. Basically, at the time, there was no way that I could afford to front them the money for that because it would have just straight up put me out of business. So we ended up splitting the cost of the material, and I remachined everything. Like I returned the parts, I remilled the parts and got it all correct or whatever. So it was super stressful. I think I did a little bit of business with them after that, but the owner was pretty pissed off. To be honest, like there was, like I said, there's enough blame to go around. You know, their inspection passed when they brought them in. They didn't provide a CAD file. They're sending out parts that were, you know, really high dollar value for a really low dollar value service. So, So that was just one of many, but I think, if you're dealing with a customer and you make a costly fuck up, I think the key thing is to do whatever it takes to basically right the situation. That's if you want to have good customer service. Generally you try to bend over backwards for your customers within reason. But I'll tell you what, if I treated my customers the way that some of my vendors treat me, mostly like plating companies, I would be out of business probably.
I think costly fuck ups is a good segue into Tony's topic.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
All right, folks. Well, today I am doing greatest hits and what have you learned from them from at Metalhead Machinist. And I'm going to start with some of the basic encounters and things that I've learned and watched along the way. And one of the first shops I worked at, I mentioned prior, was they made transmissions, specialty transmissions, gear splitters, overdrives, underdrives. And one of my good friends that got me this job was going to work on a piece of shift linkage. It was like half inch stainless steel, probably about 4 feet long. And the boss man set him up on this little teeny lathe, and he was going to thread one in half 13 so they could screw a swivel joint on the end of it and then turn around to the other end. And so it was hanging out the back of the lathe a little bit. And with him threading, you know, at 300 or 400 RPM, it was no big deal. But he decided he was going to kick it into high gear after he threaded it and take a file and knock the burr off the lead. And when he did that, that little lathe started jumping and hopping around on the floor. And there was a cart full of parts behind it. And that bar bent over and it kept swinging and throwing the parts across the room. And he was in full-blown panic. And we ran over there and turned it off. And that was pretty impressive. So I know all of you guys out there on a CNC lathe have seen that little logo of that dude standing there with the bar hanging out and it's bent and it's beating him on the head and there's blood flying out and all that good shit.
Yep.
That is for real. So I've mentioned in the past that one boss that I had, the military slave driving boss, he thought he was going to teach himself how to run the Nakamura Slant 1. And he had something similar, only it was 3/4 inch. Hanging out the back of that machine, and he fired it up. And you just really don't know how physics works until you do something like that. And this 3/4 inch bar, when he fired it up, it was going to face it. It hung out, it bent over, and then it broke off. And luckily for all of us in the shop, it flew straight up and out the skylight and landed on the roof.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it was a real eye-opener. And so to one-up that one, a screw machine shop that I worked at, this know-it-all guy had a bar 1.5 inches stainless steel on this big old Miano machine. He was going to face it and turn it. And that one didn't break off, but it was hanging out about 2 feet. And as he went to face it with constant surface footage on, it wound up and it bent over and it blew out the actuator. It hit the workbench next to the machine, broke it in half. Shit flew all over the place.
Holy
and
shit.
Luckily, it stopped. But you see, I mean, people will say, that's 1.5-inch bar stainless. I don't know hardly anything that can bend that. But if it's hanging out 2 feet and then you start winding up that machine, son of a bitch. It's really impressive on what it can do. And then luckily, all three of those instances, nobody got hurt. But it sure could have. They all could have been like that little dude on that sticker getting hit in the head with the blood fighter.
God damn. That's wild.
I gotta tell you a story. So I was running a night shift and I was setting and operating a Traub, and we were running stainless and they were like 12-inch almost like discs with a few holes in it and tapped holes, etc. And anyhow, I was absolutely busting my pants for a poo. Like it was knocking on the door, right?
You were peeking.
I was peeking, all right. I wasn't just peeking. This was
you were dilated to a 9.
It was dialing in itself. I tell you, I was dilating.
All right.
Anyway, so okay. So I was busting. I was like, oh my god, I've got to get this going. So I'd already run 2 parts. And I was like, oh man, this is sweet. I'm gonna keep it going while I go and take the mother dump. And anyhow, went
Hold
to
on.
The toilet.
Did you take a pic?
After I finished, I should have done.
Carry on.
Sorry. Okay. So it's so I was peeking and I got to. So I closed the door. I closed the door. I pressed go. Off I went, and I was like, cool. When I came back, like this machine had like a fair bit of grunt to it, and it also it didn't have the load monitor sweeps on it, which I find now a total lifesavers, but that's a completely different topic. When I opened the door, there was 5 glowing nubs that were stuck in the turret because the drill insert had melted and it carried on, and then the borer bar come round and fucking melted that, and then the finished borer bar come round and melted that, and then the threading tool come round and it melted that. It was honestly, it was like, you know, when you opened this door, I went, this is the living nightmare I've been dreaming of. there was smoke coming out, and the tool holders were virtually on fire. And I went, I didn't know this was fucking possible. Oh my god. And my supervisor at the time, he come round and he goes, what the fuck have you done, you idiot? And I was like, I just needed a poo.
You made 2 poos at the same time.
And I almost then had another poo when I opened the door.
Wow, that's I have seen that. And man, once one tool goes, they follow right up in line and boom, 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 boom.
Yep. And I said to myself, if I have got to run a part, I will make sure that I don't need a poo.
So was this a newer machine or an older machine?
It was probably maybe 8 years old. So you know it was okay.
Did those have optional stuff on it?
Oh yeah, but I was. And this is
he was going poo, man. There's no optional stop.
Just rub it. Just put a butt plug in it. What I was thinking was, you know when you were talking earlier about you know you got to learn by your mistakes, and one thing was, I was so confident that, like, it was just, it was going to run no problem. I didn't need to be there right then, you know. I'd convinced myself that it was fine for me to do that. And it was a total error. I should have at least maybe just done optional stops. So I at least did the drill in. And that would have been fine, you know. Like, at least it would have screwed a drill up, but it wouldn't have ruined everything else that was inside the or on the turret. And, yeah, that taught me a very valuable lesson. Yeah,
I worked at shops that they swore that you never left the machine when an insert drill was running. And that was because, for one, some of the machines were pretty rickety and probably not on center or what have you. But if something's going to melt or an insert's going to chip and then things are going to go to hell, insert drills usually at the beginning of it.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
All right, well, I'm going to move on to my next thing that I saw in a job shop that I was working at. And we had a really nice guy that was a CNC mill guy, and we brought him over to the lathes, and we had two big Nakamura slant fours, and they were pretty close together because we were cramped for room. And I mean, I could probably, if I stretched out, touch almost both of them at the same time, but not quite. And we were working on a part, we were making some molds, and we had three big chunks of 17-4 we're going to make molds out of. So it was three for three, and they had two ops on us and then go over to the mills and get three more ops. So we made a dummy part out of aluminum just to move it through the process so all the guys could touch the tools and go carry on, do that kind of stuff. And so the guy next to me, he was running the part in the aluminum and everything was fine. And when he was facing it, turning it, I actually took my part into QC and was getting the first article. And he made it through the aluminum part all the way. Then I came back out and he loaded his stainless part. And I'm at my machine, he's at his. And I hear he's got 15 inch chucks on him and he's holding probably about a 13 inch slug. And I'm hearing the tool come over and he's getting ready to face down the front of it. And I hear the thing winding up. I'm thinking, oh, okay, she's a little groan to her and she's going, and she's going higher and higher and higher. And I'm thinking, man, this guy did not set his constant surface footage, lockout at a certain rate. And it was up to, 1,500, almost going on 2,000. And I reached over to hit the E-stop. But before I could hit the E-stop, the thing came out of the chuck and it hit the door. And it sat there and it flew out of the chuck, hit the door and spun in the chip conveyor for like what seemed like 30 minutes, but it was probably about a minute. And that door we had to take off. And luckily for the two of us, it went, towards the side of the door and not where the door could have been, hit us or come off. And we pulled the door off and we picked up a pallet full of copper slugs that we had and smashed the door back down and then remounted it on the machine and then used to come along and tie it to my machine and ratcheted it out until we could actually get the door back in alignment. And he turned white and it was pretty scary, but that's something that sometimes gets overlooked is, limiting your RPMs on something that huge winding up that fast. And luckily, once again, nobody was hurt on that one. Mm. And at the same place, that guy that I mentioned, my military boss that actually threw that stainless out the skylight. Well, we got a brand new Matsura 900 horizontal milling machine, and he was teaching himself how to run that. And he had a big slug for the semiconductor industry mounted onto this tombstone. He's got a 5-inch shell mill, and he's facing one side, and then he backs up and he rotates it. He's ripping and facing the other side, and then he backs up and he rotates it. And this was in the late 80s, early 90s. I'm not even sure how he programmed it, but long story short, on the last rotate, he forgot to back it up and spun that tombstone into that 5-inch fly mill. And that was noisy. And my machine was right next to him, and it shook my machine, it shook him. And he walked outside and sat on the curb and he smoked his whole pack of Marlboros.
God.
I want to add as well. I did this really stupid thing where I put in a 100-kilo slug, which is like 220 pounds, into the chuck, and I'm there just kind of like, all right, I'm just looking through the program, and then I the door was closed and everything, and then I stood back, but I stood back onto the chuck pedal. And, and so I'm there, and I'm, and all I hear is a boom. I went, fuck. And I go, what the hell's going on? Who's crashed the machine? And I look around and I see the slug laying inside the conveyor. It's the fucking stupidest thing I've ever done.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that's a good one, Jody. Well, I'm going to move on to one of my in-house amazeballs crashes. I actually wasn't at the machine at this point, but, you know, don't get me wrong. I've done my share of fucked up shit, too. But this was on my newest machine at the time. It was the Akuma LT200M. And I had a machinist that, you know, a nice guy, but we're running these parts and, you know, we're plus or minus five on the length. And he wants to move it. He wants to move it in and bring the length in just dead nuts. I mean, fucking dead nuts. And so he wants to move it in minus 3/10 because he wants to get it to read just, you know, zeros on the digital micrometer. Well, he ended up moving it 3 inches.
And
the machine is the fastest one I have currently at the shop, and it's the turret's on rails. It's not on the old hardened box ways. It's on the rails, and he hits that sucker, fires it up, it comes down, it slams into that spindle so freaking loud. I mean, just instantly. I mean, we're talking like maybe 1.5 seconds. Just quad boom, and it's like he instantly went white. He is walking around the machine. He's rocking back and forth and nodding just like, you know, Dustin Hoffman in The Rain Man going, hot water, burn baby. He was just freaking going in a convulsion. It's like, you know, he had no idea what he did. And after I had to explain to him, you know, what he did, we broke it down in slow motion, and he didn't get the decimal point in there. And so it automatically assumed that he wanted 3 inches. And I think that night he probably went home and killed a handle.
So we had a kid, and he'd been running this job for like 3 weeks. And so he was pretty tuned in on it, and it was in a, it's a twin spindle machine, but just one turret. And so he went to touch off one of the sub-spindle tools, but he touched it off on the main tool offset. And it was right at the end of the day. I think we had like 20 minutes before we were heading home. And he lights that thing off, and it was full rapid, 10-inch chuck, 4,000 RPM. And it just buried the turret straight into the chuck. It ripped the double-sided VDI station completely off the turret. The pin that goes in there, it sheared that off.
Wow.
And that thing, I was standing about 10 feet away when it was happening, talking to another guy about something. And I saw the door just like kind of, you know, it looked like it budged out like 6 inches. And the kid hit the floor. Everyone else was, it was the quietest I'd ever heard that shop, like after that happened. And, you know, then you see all the faces kind of peeking around. And it hit so hard that the control was completely frozen. It like froze the hard drive on it. And because I had I went over there and the chuck was still spinning, and I hit the e-stop in there. I mean, there wasn't even an alarm displayed on the control.
Really?
And the kid was kind of he was crying. And I just told him, you know, hey, everyone's okay. You know, go ahead and go walk around, you know, because he was just really wound up. And so he went and walked around, and we basically I had to get a ladder and get up there and undo the bolts on the top of the door. And we basically had to like pry the door off of there.
Wow.
And then I pulled the chuck off. It didn't rip any of the jaws off. They were pretty fucked up. I still have them in a box.
Why do you always save that shit, Boomer? You know, like the one guy that fucked up that part, you went and saved it, and then you saved these jaws. You need a trophy.
I save stuff like that too. That's like a good reminder.
The one thing I wish I had saved was I pried a Cap 40 holder out of a spindle at the other shop I worked at. And as soon as it came out, it like split perfectly in half, like lengthwise.
Wow.
Yeah, I had to pry it out with like a 4-foot crowbar.
Nice.
That was another good one. But yeah, this one, so I pulled the chuck off and I pulled it all apart because I was like, you know, surely this thing has to be destroyed, you know. And we found a two of the master jaws were cracked, so we got a new chuck on there. Ran the spindle, and the spindle sounded fine. Pulled all the stations off the turret, realigned the turret, and we're running good parts on that machine still to this day.
When you went and got that 4-foot red or 4-foot pry bar, did you get that out of a red toolbox?
It was a brown crinkle coat box, but it was a Craftsman.
Okay, moving on. All right, so I'm going to wrap mine up. Some of the things that, you know, with crashes, prevention, you know, a lot of the older machines even still had graphics. And I know a lot of people that wouldn't run it in graphics. You can see a pretty big mistake in graphics, but not everything. Guys that just leave feed rate up to 100% and press the button, that's kind of ballsy. But if you got a new program in there, I suggest single blocking and turning the override down. I know one of the topics that people have been talking about is machines with doors open and closed. And, you know, it's getting harder and harder to be able to override that safety switch and run it with it open. But, you know, when I started machining on CNC, some of the mills didn't even have doors. So it was not, you know, always a thing. It is a bigger thing now. But if there's a way to bring it down and make sure you're where you told it to go, 100 above or 100 in front or whatever you're running the lathe or mill, I would advise that you can do that. If you step it through your program the first time and it runs it fine, then more than likely I can guarantee you that it'll keep doing it because it is a computer. But when you go in and make edits, I treat edits as a brand new program because that's where some of the most crashes can happen. You go in there and you're adjusting something or you're copying and pasting and this is going to be tits. I've got this dialed from last time. It'll come back to haunt you. My supervisor actually was always famous for copying and pasting, and we had the rough cycle down on one of them slants and we were roughing the bore and it was cool. So he went and he copied and pasted that for the finished bar to save some time. And that was fine too, but we didn't have graphics and he was running it and he brought it down and in the right spot, right feed, right spindle, let it go. It went into the face and it put on a little radius, chamfer radius, and down the bore. Nice, looking sweet, sounds perfect. Then it comes off the bore. Okay, sweet. Well, what he didn't copy and paste because it was a can cycle, and I don't even know if people use can cycles anymore, but it didn't wrap it back out to Z.1. When he sent it home, it was still on the bore, so it came up in X and Z, ripped the freaking part right off the chuck, broke the boring bar off, and it was nasty. So those kind of things, edits are, I stress, you know, you go in there and edit something, you make sure that she's good to go when you're done. Akumas are, you know, if you're running the twin spindle, a twin turret, there's ways to restart in the middle of a program. There's several different things you can do. But
restart.
One of the things that you can do is put a go-to statement in there. Yep. And I had a really good buddy of mine that was, you know, trying to save his first part. He ran it through all the steps and he cut some OD threads on it. And the OD threads were still a little tight because he checked it with the go gauge in the machine. So he put a go-to statement in there and he came down and he offset it and it was sweet. So we saved the first part and that was awesome. But what he didn't do when he got ready to run the next part was take the go-to statement out. So where it would have been rough turn, finished turn, and then ready to thread, it came down and it threaded. And that was not really worth the time of going to all that trouble to save that first part because the amount of money that we spent to fix the machine, that first part could have been thrown in the recycle bin and we would have been money ahead. the last thing I want to touch on is after. So you've done something big or small or whatever it may be. After the crash, you know, if you're new and or if you're coming up and you're just the button pusher, you need to speak up and you need to tell somebody, look, this is what happened, or I'm not sure everything's all right here, or this insert's broken and I changed it, but you want to check things out before we go. That's key. I encourage my guys to do that, because the way that I have things programmed and set up, I mean, stuff shouldn't really be breaking. I mean, there's going to be a fluke every now and then, but stuff shouldn't break. It should wear out. And if you, you know, you come down and you bump something, or whether you're manually moving a turret around because you want to check the part off and you accidentally bump the bar while it's in there, we need to talk about it. You don't just need to send it home and then start over, because if you bump that stick tool or whatever it may be, it's not going to be in the line anymore. It's either going to be cutting a little bit big or a little bit small, or it could be chipped. And, you know, bottom line is, if you bump something, even though you may think it's minor, it could be major, or even if it is major and you still don't tell somebody, thinking you're going to hide and everything's going to be cool, it's all going to come out in the wash. At the end of the day, something's not going to be right, or your shift ends on days and the night guy comes in, he sets up a new job and he's going to drill this hole and he's going to ream this hole and he's trying to get a 7RA, and all of a sudden the end mill is just looking like he's threading it. It comes out. And so I encourage people, no matter big or small it is, speak up and tell somebody, because I mean, the first thing that I would do is go over there and check to make sure the turret's still in line. I mean, that's bonus. I mean, that's how bad we can judge if it's like a bad crash or not. And then the actual tool that hit it, whether it's a turning tool or whether it's an insert drill that melted down because you're taking a poo, you know what? Hit an indicator on there and sweep that pot and make sure it's still straight. I mean, that's what you got to do. And I encourage people to come to me and tell me, look, I was taking a poo and my shit melted down. Well, I hope I sweat my pants. Let's walk over there and get to the bottom of this. What did you wipe?
Stop the podcast. Hey, Albert, did you know that if you went onto our Instagram account, you can ask us a question direct and we may pick that topic so we can talk about it on here?
No way. I had no idea.
Fuck. Well, guess what? That's what's going to happen. And next time I'm going to get a super duper haircut just like you.
Well, suck me off of the brow. You know, that'll look great on you.
Let's get on with the podcast.
I chose a topic by @CNC is awesome, which it is.
That's like a catchy name.
Yeah, it's catchy. I like it. And he wanted to know about, you know, wacky drawings or crazy engineers and just things that we've seen or things that we think are funny.
They're all crazy.
Yeah, they're all nuts. So we make our own product for the most part, and so we have a younger manufacturing engineer, and a lot of the times he'll design like some tooling for assembly or something, and he loves to just, you know, he'll draw it without ever thinking about how we're going to make it or what it's going to take to make it. And he'll put, you know, a 250 hole 4 inches deep with a flat bottom on it and, you know, plus or minus, you know, a thou on the diameter. And then it's, you know, it always happens. That'll come around on the weekend. And then those guys are calling me, how the hell are we supposed to do this? And
yeah, that's because that guy never learned how to make anything.
Exactly. And so then I'll call him and I'll be like, Drew, does that really need to be there? And then he'll say, oh no, it's just, you know, it's just clearance for a spring. And I think a lot of the time it's because their CAD software has like I think it just defaults to whatever they did last time or something. If that makes sense.
Yeah. But you're also in a unique, you know, position where you've got your design team in house. And you're able to, you know, you can then communicate with those guys and go, look, how the hell am I supposed to machine this? And they go, oh, no, it's all good. We can change it. Whereas there are quite a lot of people that, you know, they'll just get a drawing and that's it. You know, they don't have that that full kind of communication thread where they're able to talk to these design engineers and say, well, there's no way I can machine this, or, you know, if I do, it's going to be incredibly difficult. Or the other one would be, oh my God, actually, this doesn't need to be this complicated, and we could reduce the amount of time it would take to manufacture this part if you just moved, you know, a port by an inch to the left, you know, and suddenly you don't have to do this crazy setup because you can get it all done in one.
Yeah, it's definitely nice having that capability, but I mean, I didn't always have that, and we would do parts at the other shop, and there was this one customer, and every single part they had, it was a lot of these like stems, and they would have, you know, threads like out in the middle of them, and you'd go to thread it, and the thread would touch, you know, the diameter before the threads and the diameter after the threads, and then you'd try to run those at the low and it would still touch just because of the way they were dimensioned. And it was something that kind of always drove me crazy. And then you'd tell them like, hey, the bolt isn't, or the nut isn't going to go on here. And then you say, oh, we'll just bore it out then, you know, and you'd send them the parts, and they'd call and say, hey, you know, the thread shouldn't have touched this, we're pretty sure. And then, you know, you'd ask them, well, did you look in Machinery's Handbook and, you know, calculate everything out? Well, no, we just measured this nut we got from McMaster, and we know it fits over that, but we don't want those lines from the threader on there. And we saw a lot of that. And then we had this one customer that was a real pain in the ass, and they'd put like we did this Delrin part, and they wanted a 16 finish on it. Okay, easy enough. So we send them the parts, and then they send them back, the parts aren't shiny enough. Well, okay, it meets the surface finish criteria. You know, what else do you want? Well, we want you to polish them. Well, that's not on the print, you know. So they send us all this literature on how they polish plastic. I don't know why they couldn't just do it. And so we buy all this shit and we polish them. And then they were on my way home. And so I stopped by and dropped them off. And then the guy was like, oh, I want to make sure they fit. It was a it was a door stop.
It went on this little. I thought you were going to say it was a butt plug.
But I it want was to make sure.
Sorry, but it Bones. Went on. It was a piece of electronic equipment, and it went on the inside of the door, and it was what, you know, when you close the door, it was what butted up against something else and stopped the door. And it needed a 16 finish that was polished.
Oh my lanta.
And then they had some other parts, and it says right on there, you know, rack the parts here. And so we get them back from the anodizer, and they're absolutely beautiful, and we send them to the customer, and then they call back and they say, hey, we're sending these back. There's some holes that we see a shiny spot down in these holes. Like, what are you talking about? And so they sent them back, and then it's the hole that it says to rack the part on. They're upset that there's a shiny spot in the bottom of the hole. So our inspector there, this is at the old shop, he took a Sharpie and he colored the shiny spot with the Sharpie and then sent the parts back, and they accepted them. But anyways, back to what you're saying, we do that quite a bit, where we'll do if we have a very complicated design and it's something that we haven't really made before, we'll actually do a design review. And we'll have it'll typically be me or one of the other guys in there with the engineers, and then we'll have someone from production in there so they can look at, you know, how are we going to put this thing together. We'll have someone from QC in there, you know, how are we going to inspect this, and we do that quite a bit, and things will go through, you know, three or four revisions before we even start cutting metal. And it really does kind of make it, a lot better for us. And I mean, we can make things, you know, cheaper that way too.
Yeah.
So I think it's real important. And also our head engineer, I mean, he started the company himself, and he bought a machine and started making parts. And so he knows what's easy to do, what's not easy to do. When it's something that he spearheads and a project that he leads, we rarely have any issues on machinability.
Cool.
Yeah, that is really cool. And you're right, Albert, the communication is always key, isn't it? You know, if you communication and relationship, you know, if you've got a good relationship with your customer or, you know, your engineering team, then we should be able to work around those machining issues to because you all want the best outcome at the end of the day.
Yeah, everybody does. Yeah.
This was a question from Tom Lipton, aka Ox Tools, and he's got a pretty good YouTube following and a good YouTube channel. He wanted to know what and how we approach interviewing. You know, do we look for particular skills? Do we put like a test in place to see how people work? Or do we just go on the seat of our pants and just hire and just go, righto, we'll just give them a go? So from my perspective, I've had quite a few years of interviewing people now, and not just people locally, but I've also flown to Manila and interviewed machinists that were working at big companies in Manila. And I've also conducted interviews on Skype, which, because they're not even in the country, because geographically we're at the arse end of nowhere down here. And as we said before about getting decent skilled people, this is sort of what we have to do. And when I interview someone, let me take one step back. So you get a CV, and for anybody that's going to apply for a job, you know, your CV really is, it should look good, you know, because at the end of the day, the first thing that any interviewer is going to see is your CV. So you look at it and go, oh, well, this guy's had 10 jobs in 3 months. I'm not even going to bother, because there's is either like got no skill, or he's just got a bad attitude, or she. Do you know what I mean?
And yes.
And so you kind of discount that. And then, so you kind of whittle through the pile and go, well, this guy has this particular experience. And of course it all depends on what job you're getting applicants for, but you look for people that have at least written down that they've got a good skill set, and they have been able to show that they have X amount of experience. But as we all know, most CVs are just normally full of bullshit, but it's okay, because they should be there. It's like a little sales tool that you're using to at least be able to get your foot in the door. Then when you get the guys in, for me personally, when I'm interviewing people locally, of course I look at the skill set on the CV, but then it really for me is how well that first impression, do you get a good vibe from somebody? Because if you already have a bad vibe when someone starts the interview, it's a dead duck. You're not, that person is probably not going to fit into your team if you've already got like this. I can't really describe it. It's like a, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like it's
cohesive.
It's, yeah. You know, like you want someone, because like every company works differently. So it's really great when someone has experience and they know how to run X amount of machines, but every single company works in a different way. So no matter who you are, no matter where you come from, you have to learn as soon as you walk in the door. And it's the guys that come in that have a positive attitude, have shown that they've got experience. You know, those are the guys, in my experience, they're the ones that end up staying and will be good employees. And yeah, I don't know where I'm going with that. That's
I get what you're saying, and it's like I rely pretty heavily on my first impression. If they get a call in because I've seen their resume and I you know, I like what I see, and I give them a call in. I had one guy come in and he said like 10 words the entire time. And wow. So I tried to get him to, you know, talk, and I was like, well, tell me about, you know, what you did at this place.
And he went, boom.
He said contract programming.
Oh, Jesus.
And that's wow. all he said.
Jesus. And, even when you met him, you said, what's your name? He went, contract programmer. What have you done? Contract programming. What are you doing tonight? Contract programming.
I came into the room and went to shake his hand. He didn't even stand up.
Oh, no. I'd be like, get the bad fuck sign. Out.
That and, is bad. That and, you know, bad. And a part of it, too, is it's, you know, it's always that thing is it's like there's a lot of really talented machinists that are fucking assholes.
That's true.
Personal skills maybe aren't their forte.
And I've worked with enough of them. I don't need to do that again. And
I have to.
I gotta say, when I was flying to Manila, I took like a little test station with me. So I took three different components that we manufacture at where I work now, and I took over some micrometer, wall thickness mic, a digital vernier caliper, and a few other little and some plug gauges and stuff, and I made a little test table, and I was always looking for this was always the thing, like a lot of the guys that work in Asia, they're all about showing how fast they can work, but actually it's the guys that you can see that maybe are a little bit slower, but are really set on getting the quality right and the measurement skills right. They're the guys that I want.
And, right.
And one of the, and this is probably not a good thing to do, but I did it anyway. On the vernier caliper, I would offset it by 0.1 of a mil and then zero it. So it was already wrong. And then what's the first thing you do when you pick up a vernier? You pick it up.
You make sure it reads zero. You open it up.
You clean the tongs and then you put them back and you go, oh, it's I'm going to zero it. And then I do it again. I go, oh, cool. It's reading zero. Now, you know, it was amazing how many people came into that interview room with me. Mm-hmm. And first of all, I went through the personal part and they said, look, we're going to do a 10-minute test. I've got three parts there. I just want you to measure them to the best of your ability. And the guys that never picked up the micrometers, they never got employed by me. But also, the guys that picked up the vernier and then measured everything with the vernier without zeroing it, they were also not employed by me. But then there was the guys that would pick them up and they would zero it. I go, well, at least he's got one thing. But, you know, if they then never used any of the mics, they didn't get a job.
I thought you were going to...
I worked with this old guy,
yeah,
and anytime I always clean like my 0 to 1, I always like, you know, close it on the print and then pull the paper out.
Yeah, nobody even knows that shit anymore, Boomer. And, I'm just saying the same thing.
And he'd be standing over there in his little area, and he'd always yell, "Measure the part, not the drawing."
Oh, fuck you.
So, what about you guys? What are you, you know, Albert? What do you do when you're interviewing people? How do you? How do you conduct yourself?
You touched on it. I mean, I would say gut instinct is a pretty big part of it. You know, like reading somebody's body language, just picking up on little things like, are they standing up to shake your hand? Are they talking over you? You know, I want to hear them talk about themselves, but by the same token, like when you chime in, like they shouldn't be talking over you. They shouldn't be asking immediately about like, how much it makes or what type of benefits they're getting. Like they should be getting a feel for what the work environment is like. And just generally I try to read to see like how good of a listener they are too. You know, yeah. not necessarily always like machinist skills, but more people skills. I'd rather right. hire somebody that, you know, could communicate well and I guess was probably easy to work with, because you could probably train them if they don't know how to do something.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've got somebody with like an attitude problem, I mean, you're going to have the complete opposite problem, and they're going to be the elephant in the room then, you know?
What do you guys think about guys that come to interview for a position in the shop and they come in with like a suit and tie and polished shoes and all of that stuff?
They're straight out of college.
Unnecessary. I mean, I try to not let it like cloud my judgment on who they are as a person and like what they're bringing to the table, but like, it's not necessary. You're going to be in a fucking shop. Like, you know, don't show up with like a Limp Bizkit t-shirt on or something, but like,
well, now you're a picky bastard.
It's well, all about the I mean, music. There's a happy medium here. You know, you don't want to look like you're just out partying or something. I had a dude come in for an interview once, and he had jeans on and like a wrinkled button up shirt. You could tell he just like pulled it out of the hamper or something. And that kid,
what's wrong with that?
Reeked like alcohol. Reeked like alcohol. And it was like, I could tell that he thought that he was like dressing up nice for an interview or whatever, but it's like, you know, the alcohol thing just kind of tipped me over. It's like, all right, this kid's priorities are fucked. So
what? I had no idea that you interviewed Boomer.
And Boomer's, wait, off, Boomer's this way more handsome. Stupid, anyways.
I wrote down like a top four. Like, you must not do this if you are going to an interview.
Okay.
Okay. So this is my top four. Right.
Okay.
And
sounds like David Letterman, huh, Boomer?
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Number four.
Jodak.
Do not turn up to an interview in your jandals. Like,
what?
Contrary to popular belief, I do not walk around in my jandals in the shop. I tell you now. So do not.
All right.
Okay. Next, number three would be, do not turn up in a Hawaiian shirt and tracksuit bottoms. Because I am
wow.
not going,
unless it's
you.
Aloha Friday, that's acceptable then.
or if you're in Albert's realm, don't have an Hawaiian shirt on and a Limp Bizkit t-shirt underneath it. Number two, absolutely leave your cell phone in the car, because the worst thing is when you're sitting there interviewing someone and they go, oh, hold on a minute, mate, I just need to text my mum. I'm like, yeah, you can tell her to come pick you up, because there's no fucking job here, buddy. And number one, without a doubt, if you are going for an interview, you must not turn up late. Oh, my yep. God. Like, that is basic rule of any job that you are going to apply for. Like, if you value that job, you will be there fucking half an hour before or a day before, whatever is going to make it that you are not late for that yeah. interview. Because the worst thing, if I have to sit here waiting, looking at my clock, and suddenly someone goes, oh, there was a problem and I'm 30 minutes late, it's like, well, actually there's no point in coming, because if you yeah. can't even get there for the interview, there is probably no way you're even going to be able to turn up for time to work on time, like when you actually get employed.
I yep. agree.
There you go. That's my top four.
That's episode three done. Remember, go into our Instagram account and send us a DM with your topic and we will discuss it. Okay, until next time. Bye.